This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When should we get out of Iraq, and how should we do it? Those are the questions we're going to spend the next couple of days discussing with military leaders, prominent Iraqis, policy analysts, and journalists. The first of today's five guests is Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle. Along with General Petraeus, Nagle was on the team that wrote the new U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. He was the operations officer of a tank battalion task force that was deployed to Iraq's Anbar province in 2003 and 4. Nagle now commands the 1st Battalion 34th Armor at Fort Riley, Kansas, where he's training teams of combat advisors who will be sent to Iraq. We called him at Fort Riley. Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you think it's time now to get out of Iraq, and if not now, when?
Terry, I believe that the United States has an enduring interest in security and stability, not just in Iraq, but throughout the region. And I am afraid that an American commitment to Iraq is going to continue to be required for a number of years.
When you say a number of years, you mean 2, 5, 10, 20?
I'm afraid it's going to be between 10 and 20. The history of counterinsurgency campaigns suggests that, as T. E. Lawrence noted, they are messy and slow. The average counterinsurgency campaign takes about 10 years to conclude. There are no indications that the counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq will be shorter than average. So my assessment is that an American commitment to the security of Iraq will be required for at least a decade. I think that over time, that commitment will increasingly shift from a U.S. combat role to a U.S. advisory role.
So for the kind of presence that you're talking about, how many troops are you talking about? What kind of military commitment are you describing?
I think that tens of thousands of American troops will be required for a number of years, probably a decade. Foreign forces can't win a counterinsurgency campaign. Only local forces can do that. But history also suggests that local forces are much more effective when they're strengthened and enabled by advanced foreign armies who bring some special capabilities to the table that host nation armies often don't have. And there I'm thinking of intelligence assets, of logistics assets, and of airstrikes and artillery support, that it can take a long time for a developing army to grow into.
Now, you say that you think we're going to need American troops in Iraq for a long time. And Iraq's defense minister said this week that Iraq wouldn't be able to take responsibility for its internal security until the year 2012 and wouldn't be able to defend its borders on its own until 2018. Does his statement jive with your thoughts?
Almost exactly. The mission of providing internal security is a difficult one, given the challenges that Iraq confronts. Although we've seen some good signs very recently on the political front, with the de-bathification law amendments being passed really just this week, so there are some signs of the political reconciliation that is absolutely essential to success in any counterinsurgency campaign. Very happy about that. That said, it is going to take probably another 5 years, as the Iraqi defense minister suggested, to come to terms with the internal conflict in Iraq. Even after that point, however, Iraq lives in a difficult neighborhood. The Iranians are still not fond of Iraq as an entity. Obviously, some very bad blood dating back to the 1980s and before between those two countries. And defending Iraq against an Iranian threat is in the long-term interests of the United States, is in the long-term interests of the Iraqi people, and is going to take even more work than getting the Iraqi forces able to confront the irregular internal threat that they're currently working to fight.
Could you describe what the military is doing differently with the surge?
I can. The most interesting thing to the so-called surge for me is not the additional 30,000 American troops that we've committed into the fight in Iraq. It's that we've committed them very differently. General Petraeus had the remarkable opportunity to spend a year thinking hard about counterinsurgency, was the lead author, the driving force behind the U.S. Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. And that strategy relied on providing protection to the population of Iraq. We'd previously done an awful lot of clearing operations. We had cleared the enemy out of sector, but we hadn't had either the troops nor a full understanding of counterinsurgency principles to lead us to understand that once you've cleared, you have to hold what you've cleared, and if possible, you hold with host nation security forces strengthened by American advisors, and then you rebuild a society in that territory you're holding. And it's been called an oil spot strategy, and it slowly spreads across the face of the country that's afflicted by insurgency.
One of the programs that David Petraeus has been overseeing is the paying of Sunni militia leaders. Would you describe that program and its rationale?
Historically, in a counterinsurgency campaign, you don't kill or capture all your enemies. You actually convince them to come over to your side. You convince them that it isn't worth fighting you. Instead, you come to some accordance of interest, and agreements tend to be negotiated. You don't have surrender agreements on the deck of the Missouri, but shui shui, slowly, slowly, in Arabic, the insurgency whimpers away. And what General Petraeus has done is an outreach program that actually we started. I was actually in Al Anbar back in 2003, 2004, and made some very halting gestures in this direction. I held meetings with Sunni sheikhs, with Sunni tribal leaders, and tried to convince them that it was in their interest to work with us. I'm not sure I succeeded as much as I would have liked to, but did manage to plant some seeds. And over the 3 years, the 4 years since that time, that process has continued. There's been continued negotiations between Army and Marine leaders in Al Anbar with some of these Sunni leaders, some of them, frankly, insurgent leaders, or at least favorably inclined toward the insurgency if they're not actually insurgent fighters themselves. In one case I know of, a Marine general officer traveled to a nearby country to talk to one of the Sunni leaders who was in exile there to try to work these negotiations. So it's a diplomatic process as much as a military process, and it's one that, after years of hard work, is bearing remarkable fruit, and it has turned some of our enemies not just not against us, but has turned them against our common enemy, al-Qaeda in Iraq. And that is one of the key reasons for the success that General Petraeus saw in 2007.
So how much do we pay each leader, and what do we expect in return for that payment?
We pay them, as I understand it, about $10 a day, and we do not provide them with weapons in most cases. Most of them have weapons, have AK-47s, and that's all the weapons they need for the missions they're doing. And it's sort of a neighborhood watch on steroids. What these folks do is ensure that the people in their locality belong there, and they remove foreign fighters, al-Qaeda in Iraq, by whatever means are necessary. There are obviously some dangers in that kind of approach. But
what are those dangers?
Well, the danger is that you've got citizens taking law into their own hands.
You discovered this little instruction manual for American servicemen in Iraq during World War II, and you thought it was so interesting, you had it republished and wrote an introduction for it. And in that introduction, you said, the key to success in a counterinsurgency campaign is providing enough security to the people that they feel empowered to reveal the identity of the killers who hide among them in plain sight. The local people will identify the insurgents to you, but only if they believe you will be with them for the long haul to prevent reprisals. What are the implications of that for the United States?
Terry, you did me too much credit. It was actually the University of Chicago who found that lovely little book. The implications of the passage you read, that is that population security is the essence of success in any counterinsurgency campaign. That is the driving force behind the counterinsurgency strategy that General Petraeus has implemented in Iraq over the past year. The real problems I saw when I was there early on in 2003, 2004, a number of the people, in my opinion, believed that their long-term interests were with the government of Iraq. But short-term, they couldn't take that risk. They were not secure enough. We didn't have Iraqi security forces in sufficient numbers or of sufficient quality that they could protect the Iraqi people against reprisals. We are now moving toward a position where the Iraqi security forces are good enough, and the people sense the momentum. It's like a football game. They understand that it is now more likely that the government of Iraq will protect them over the long term and will be able to prevent them from being hurt even in the short term. And that is what has led to the decisions to eradicate al-Qaeda in Iraq, largely on the part of the Iraqi people and the Sunni tribes, who were the heart of the insurgency. The folks I was fighting against in 2003, 2004, in 2007, decided to get rid of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Iraq is better as a result of that.
Part of the goal, maybe the largest part of the goal of the surge, was to create a kind of stability in Iraq that would enable the political process to proceed and to, you know, for a political infrastructure to be created. Do you think that the surge is actually leading to that larger goal? The surge has been successful militarily in many ways, but is it leading toward that larger goal of the political process moving forward?
2 weeks ago, Terry, I would have agreed almost completely with the premise of that question. I would have argued that although the surge has produced security, much better security, through large portions of Iraq, the political progress that was the ultimate objective of that military security was not forthcoming. Literally in the past week, the Iraqi government has taken steps that make me enormously is too strong, that make me cautiously optimistic that this Iraqi government is going to take the reconciliation steps that it needs to take, the passage of the oil law, the bringing former Baathists back into the government once they've been properly vetted, bringing the concerned local citizens' councils into the Iraqi government and making them officially part of the Iraqi security forces. It is now much more possible that those things are going to happen. There's no guarantee, but I'm much more hopeful than I was just 2 weeks ago that we're going to see the political progress that our soldiers have paid for at such great cost over the course of 2007.
Have you ever felt during the course of the war in Iraq that there was a disconnect between the political goals of the war and what the military could actually achieve?
David Galula is a famous in my world at least, French Army officer, a counterinsurgent, who wrote a wonderful book called Counterinsurgency Warfare Theory and Practice, based on his experiences in Algeria back in the late 1950s. He wrote the book in 1963. And we relied heavily on Galula's work when we were writing the Army Marine Corps Counterinsurgency Field Manual. Galula says that in any counterinsurgency campaign, only 20% of the fight is military, 80% of the fight is political, economic, diplomatic, and informational. I believe that the military has done a remarkable job and has demonstrated the ability to learn and adapt. We were not as ready for counterinsurgency as we should have been in 2003, but we've learned, we've adapted, we've gotten better at it. We need concomitant political progress, not just from the Iraqi government, but also from all of the other elements of national power here in the United States, which also were not as prepared to wage counterinsurgency, to win the 80% of the fight that is political. Neither our political forces nor our diplomatic forces were as ready to wage this war as they should have been. But we have adapted and learned, and we are making progress. It would be horrific to me if, having made so much progress, learned so much, and come so far after admittedly not a very good start, were we to forsake all of that progress and leave an Iraq that is not just a humanitarian tragedy for people I know and people who have fought with me, but also a lasting security threat to the region and to the United States. And I'm very hopeful that America will remain committed to this fight, understanding that we as a military have learned and adapted and are getting better at this kind of war.
Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle spoke to us from Fort Riley. Today and tomorrow, we're asking military leaders, prominent Iraqis, policy analysts, and journalists, when and how should we get out of Iraq? Our next guest, Ali Alawi, was the Minister of Trade and the Minister of Defense under the interim Iraq Governing Council from 2003 to 2004, and then was Minister of Finance in the Iraqi transitional government between 2005 and 2006. He fled Iraq as a teenager and didn't return until after the U.S. invasion. In the interim, he developed a successful career in finance. He now divides his time between Iraq and England, where he teaches at Oxford University. His book, The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace, was published last year. Ali Alawi, welcome to Fresh Air. In January of 2007, you wrote, what was supposed to be a straightforward process of overthrowing a dictatorship and replacing it with a liberal-leaning and secular democracy under the benign tutelage of the U.S. has instead turned into an existential battle for identity, power, and legitimacy that is affecting not only Iraq, but the entire tottering state system in the Middle East. Did you ever think that overthrowing Saddam Hussein was going to be like a straightforward, easy process?
Not really. I mean, if you go back to the 1990s when we were all active in the opposition and as the build-up to the war took place, we thought it was really quite a straightforward military issue where the regime would be overthrown in a matter of weeks. And then it was a question of undoing the dictatorship over the last three decades. We never thought that the age-old issues that were hidden under the surface in Iraq would erupt in such a way, and that we would be given a kind of interval to put the new order into place. But this was not to be, obviously.
Do you want the U.S. troops to leave?
Yes, I mean, I do want them to leave, and I've gone on record before as saying that they should leave, but I think they should leave not just under the domestic pressures of the United States, of domestic U.S. politics, but they should leave only after a reasonably stable and orderly system is retained in Iraq and the Middle East as a whole. And I think that requires a shift in U.S. emphasis from just securing the landscape in Iraq, as it were, to one where they proactively work towards a future for Iraq that is in equilibrium in its, inside the country as well as with the regional powers.
What would the consequences be if the United States started to withdraw now or very soon, before the kind of stable political government that you want to see is in place?
Well, I think what will happen is that the security institutions of the government, namely the army and the police and the intelligence services, will basically fall under the sway of whoever is responsible for the government right now. They'll be factionalized. But the main issue is not whether we have a stable political order. This will not happen for a long time. The main issue is whether we have enough central government security forces that are able to withstand low-level assaults or even higher-level assaults from insurgents and from terrorists. I don't think we are very far from that. And when I say that, I mean maybe 6 to 9 months. We will have enough divisions, perhaps 5 or 6 well-trained divisions. We have a reasonably good police force. There's a big question mark about the intelligence apparatus because it is still not loyal to the Iraqi government. It's in fact managed and operated as an extension of the American intelligence apparatus. This has to change. So sometime around the summer or maybe the autumn of this year, I think we should be in that position. So if the United States gives a date certain, say December 31st, 2008, I think that would not be too far off. And this is what I would in fact call for.
Do you think that there's likely to be a civil war between Sunni, Shia, and Kurds when the United States withdraws?
No, definitely not. I think what you call a civil war has already taken place, and frankly, one side has won. What we have now is a situation where it is highly improbable that the Shia majority would allow itself to be marginalized again. Now, whether they take this as a signal to build a sectarian state is another matter. I hope not. What has happened now is the balance of power inside Iraq has shifted, in my mind, permanently, if you look at Iraq in sectarian terms. What we must do now is to build a non-sectarian basis of politics, which is another set of issues and challenges, where the United States cannot play, I think, a large contributing part.
Now, how do you see your future? You were active in the government as a minister and an advisor after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. We're speaking to you now from London. You're teaching now at Oxford University. Do you plan on becoming an active member of the government again? Do you plan on going back to Iraq? Like, project for us how you see your future in the changing Iraq?
I see my future in Iraq, obviously. I mean, I was there only a few weeks ago, and I'm intent to spend far more time there. The main issue to me personally is security, in the sense that I have to have enough comfort that I would not be personally attacked or shot. I've already been a target of two serious assassination attempts, so I have to be careful about these things. But once this is sorted out, and I hope it would be this year, then I see my personal future back in Iraq.
So there have been two assassination attempts against you that you know of, so you don't think it's safe enough for you to go back and be a member of government, and that, I guess, is an example of part of the problem in developing a real political process in Iraq. If it's not safe to be in government, what kind of government can you have?
Well, that's an issue, but I think it's more safe now than it was before. I mean, I was in Baghdad, as I said, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I could only get around with about 15 people as bodyguards. Now, I hope that the average number would not be 15, it would be, say, 5. At that point, I think it would allow us to freely travel around the country.
Ali Alawi, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Ali Alawi served in the interim Iraq Governing Council and the Iraq Transitional Government. He teaches at Oxford University. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we're asking the question, when and how should we get out of Iraq? Our next guest, General Sir Michael Rose, is a retired British Army general. In a 2006 commentary in the British newspaper The Guardian, he called for the impeachment of then Prime Minister Tony Blair for leading England to war under false pretenses. Rose commanded the UN Protection Force in Bosnia in 1994 and then became Adjutant General of the British Army. He's written a book about the Revolutionary War and lessons that can be applied to the war in Iraq. It's called Washington's War and will be published in the U.S. in April. General Sir Michael Rose, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start by asking you, where did you stand on the invasion of Iraq?
Well, from the outset, of course, I'd been following the events developing in the Middle East quite closely, and I'd also been reading a lot of the intelligence material that was being published in the United Kingdom. In particular, the famous Blair dossier, which was published in September of 2002. I was persuaded from the outset that any invasion of Iraq would be based on a false premise and would result in a catastrophe both for the people of Iraq and for the Western powers, who, of course, his first priority is fighting global terror. And by invading Iraq, of course, we were going to make it almost impossible for the West to be able to mobilize the very people we need to help us fight Al-Qaeda, and that are the Muslim people of the world.
Now, in June, you said, there's no way we're going to win the war, and we should withdraw and accept defeat because we're going to lose on a more important level if we don't. Would you explain what you meant there?
What I meant was that by continuing with this costly, unnecessary, and probably unwinnable war, we would be alienating the very people of the world, the Muslim people of the world. We would be continuing to alienate them and make them hostile parties at a time when we needed their help to fight the very real threat from Al-Qaeda. And our position in the Muslim world, the Western countries' position in the Muslim world, has been greatly damaged by the invasion of Iraq. Now, the arguments that are arrayed against that are that, of course, by pulling out of Iraq, we would be allowing the insurgents and the terrorists to win. And I just do not believe that to be the case, because, of course, what you would be doing, it would be handing over the responsibility for security to the Iraqi forces and the Iraqi government completely, and they would therefore be in the forefront of the war against terrorism alongside the Western countries. And, of course, they know far better how to fight the war than we do.
Now, this week, Iraq's defense minister said that Iraq wouldn't be able to take full responsibility for its internal security until the year 2012, and wouldn't be able to defend its borders from outside threats until 2018. So how does the United States take that into account?
I don't think we've been doing it very effectively even whilst we've been there. And I certainly don't think what he says is necessarily true. He has a strong vested interest in retaining the money and the support that he's currently getting from the American presence. I don't think that we should disconnect from supporting the Iraqi armed forces. And indeed, I think that the continuing program of arming and equipping and training them would probably go on. But I do not believe that we should remain on the ground in Iraq as an army of occupation.
So when do you think we should get out? Should there be a timetable? Should we be setting a date? And if so, what should that date be?
I think we should certainly give some kind of time frame for withdrawal. That would place the responsibility for their own security on the Iraqis in a way that possibly they're trying to put off at the moment, because they have a vested interest in the continuing presence, certainly the present administration there, of the American forces. The fact that there's been such a rapid improvement in the security situation has not necessarily come about because of the additional 20,000 troops, the so-called surge that took place last year. It's mainly come about because the David Petraeus, General David Petraeus, of whom I have an enormous respect and who, of course, understands far more about insurgency wars than I do, I think he's accepted that America needs to bring on side the Sunni insurgents. Of course, the Sunni tribes are not endemically anti-West or anti-American. Indeed, for many years, they were our strongest allies in the West. But by disempowering them, we alienated them and forced them into an insurgency. And by bringing them on side now, albeit we'll be abandoning our democratic dream, I think we are making Iraq ultimately a more safe and secure place.
You're referring to the fact that General Petraeus' strategy is in part to pay Sunni militia leaders and Sunni sheikhs and tried to get them to stop the insurgency and team up with us in fighting al-Qaeda.
I think General Petraeus' strategy of bringing the Sunni on side is an essential one, and one that should have been taken a long time ago.
So, but when we pull out and we stop paying the Sunni militia leaders, might they take up arms again in something like a civil war?
I think a civil war is likely. I think there is going to be some great convulsion in that country at the very least, because the Sunni will certainly use their training and their equipment and their arming to try and regain power in that country. And, of course, the Shia will try and stop that happening.
So is there anything that the United States should be doing before it withdraws or as it withdraws or after it withdraws to try to prevent that from happening?
Well, a cynic would say that that is the very thing that America's a policy that America wishes to happen. America, I think, would be more comfortable with a Sunni, albeit a non-democratic government in Iraq, than having a Shia government there, which, of course, always one suspects may have the hand of Iran controlling it.
Now, the Brits withdrew from Basra last summer, and you wrote, the British government, having declared that the Iraqis were now capable of good governance and could look after their own security, withdrew their troops from Basra and concentrated their remaining forces into a single base at the airport. This was done regardless of the true qualities on the ground. Are you saying that the British declared success even though they hadn't really achieved it, and then they pulled out?
Well, of course, that's exactly what we did. We'd be making very little impact right from the start on, I mean, other than having got rid of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athists in the south, we made very little impact on the three main pillars of good governance, security, or reconstruction. We were too few in number, and our resources in financial terms were far too small. And so we were merely there, in a way, as a form of camouflage for the American presence to the north. We were never able to control the behavior of the police in Basra, or indeed how the administration was functioning. And, of course, corruption is one of the greatest threats to the stability of Iraq, and that's certainly true in the south. And I don't think we ever went and were able to solve that. So we did what was necessary, declared victory, and we have virtually gone.
So what have the consequences been in Basra? What did the British leave behind?
We left behind a more stable form of rule in which the Iraqis are running their own affairs in their own way. I mean, the policemen who we, for 5 years, have taken to our training colleges in the United Kingdom merely returned back to Iraq and in many cases continued with their traditional ways of getting convictions, which of course was arrest, torture, confession, conviction. Nothing has changed. Also, the women's rights are not being properly respected, and the two competing militias are still fighting for power in the south. There was nothing we could have done about it, given the lack of numbers that we deployed.
What are the lessons, if any, there for the United States?
Well, I think the lessons for the United States come not from necessarily from the war in Iraq today, but from the American War of Independence, when Britain, the global superpower, which suffered the similar arrogance and hubris of a superpower that America administration had when it invaded Iraq, accepted finally defeat. The administration was thrown out at the time, the administration of Lord North and Germain and George III, and far-sighted people who had the moral courage to accept defeat and see through the consequences of defeat were able to recover Britain's position in the end of the 18th century and allow us to prepare for a much greater threat, which of course was from France. And within 25 years of withdrawing from North America and giving the Americans responsibility for their own future, we were taking on the greatest military genius the world had ever seen, and Napoleon. And we would not have been able to do that had we not halted that unnecessary and, as I say, costly and unwinnable war in 1785. And at that point, we immediately started to lay down the keels of new ships and rebuild our armies so we could take on a greater threat. And indeed, we went on to build our great empire. And neither America nor Great Britain would have become the two forces for good in the world that we became in the 19th century, and indeed in the 20th century, had we not had the moral courage to accept defeat in 1785.
Is the analogy there that you think the United States should be preparing to fight a bigger enemy, i.e., Al-Qaeda?
That is absolutely so. And our continuing presence in Iraq is making it very difficult for us to win friends amongst the Muslim people of the world, the very people we need to mobilize on our side if we're ever going to make proper progress against Al-Qaeda transnationally. Now, of course, within Iraq, and particularly in the Sunni Triangle, Al-Qaeda have been virtually eliminated. Why have they been eliminated? Because the very people who brought them into Iraq and employed them, the Sunni, and of course they only did that to help them fight the army of occupation, have now changed sides with and joined forces with the Americans, and of course are leading them to their old former allies, we're able to destroy them.
But what kind of security and order and human rights do we owe Iraq before pulling out after the chaos that we created?
Well, of course, we can't just walk away and leave the Iraqis completely to their own affairs. They will not only, because we invaded their country and allowed situations of chaos, disorder and killing to happen in that country. I mean, we must remember that some 2 million people, mainly middle-class professionals, have fled from that country, and there have been another 2 million people displaced within that country, leaving aside all the damage and the killings that have happened within that country. And, of course, they will need enormous help to try and rebuild themselves in the future. But one shouldn't underestimate the ingenuity and the technical ability and the sophistication of the Iraqi people. The presence of the foreign occupier has torn them apart in a way that they've not been torn apart before. And I think that our departure will make it easy for them to work together, shoulder to shoulder, albeit with a bit of help from outside, to rebuild and reconstruct their country, not as a model of Western liberal-style democracy, but as a country that is stable, functioning, moderate, and an ally of the West.
You're a general who has opposed the war in Iraq, knowing that, you know, your men were there fighting it, and people from your regiment are now in Afghanistan. So what is it like for you to believe that the fighting isn't going to achieve the political goals and yet really have your heart with the men who are fighting?
Well, of course, everything I say has come about as a result of either visits on the ground in Iraq or else talking to young soldiers and their officers about the realities. And, of course, they cannot speak out. And I believe it is a moral responsibility for retired military who can understand the difficulties that they're up against, although the politicians apparently can't, to speak up for them in the political field. And that's exactly what I've been doing for the past 7 or 8 years. I applaud the professionalism and the heroism and the determination of the young men and women, both in America and from my own country, fighting in the front line. But unless there are the right political platform and there is a sense of realism about the resources and the strategies that are being employed, then, of course, they're unnecessarily wasting life, and that one cannot live with.
Well, General Sir Michael Rose, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
General Sir Michael Rose's book, Washington's War, will be published in the U.S. in April. Today and tomorrow, we're asking, when and how do we get out of Iraq? My next guest, Kanan Makia, was one of the Iraqi exiles who advocated the U.S. invasion of Iraq. In 1992, he convened the Human Rights Committee for the Iraqi National Congress, a transitional parliament based in northern Iraq. Under the pseudonym Samir al-Khalil, he wrote The Republic of Fear, The Politics of Iraq, which became a bestseller after Iraq invaded Kuwait. Makiya is now a professor at Brandeis University and is the founder of the Iraq Memory Foundation, which is preserving the record of Saddam Hussein's crimes against the Iraqi people. Kanan Makiya, welcome to Fresh Air. Just start by telling us where you stood on the invasion of Iraq.
I supported the war on the basis of the nature of the necessity to remove this particular odious regime. That was my point of departure in being for the war.
Did it go the way you thought it would?
No, it didn't.
Do you think the U.S. should pull out now? And if not now, when?
I think pulling out now will have very enormous consequences on Iraq to begin with, but also on the whole Middle East. Iraq is not likely to hold together with a precipitate and fast withdrawal, because while there have been very significant gains on the military front with the surge, these have not translated yet into political gains. The political class that has emerged out of the 2003 war is in many ways a disappointment, and it has not yet been able to bring about the consensus amongst many different parties in Iraq. It has not been able to build the coalitions and to create the discourse of a single national country with a purpose heading towards reconstruction and development and so on. It signally failed on all these fronts, and it tends to behave in a very sectarian way. So in those kinds of circumstances, while it is true there have been very significant military gains, withdrawal would simply lead to a rollback of those military successes, because we need to solidify them with political gains.
So what kind of political gains are you looking for? Like, what would be the right time? What would the benchmarks be?
I'm looking for a change in the way the government functions. At the moment, the Iraqi government is beholden to the constituent parts that won victory in the 2005 elections. So, for instance, ministers are parceled out according to different factions. Muqtada Sadr gets X number of ministers and X number of portfolios. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution gets another. The Kurds get more portfolios. That means that government is formed not on the basis of people who are best at what they do, are professionals and technicians and technocrats, but rather based upon shifting alliances within the dominant bloc, the Shiite bloc. That system results in paralysis at the governmental level. We have seen it over and over again, and no prime minister of the three or so who've been in office since the change in sovereignty has been able to overcome the inefficiencies it causes. It results in a prime minister who's unable to act and unable to have his authority actually carried out. So that's probably the biggest obstacle. And the other is a way of looking at politics, which is one in which a discourse is created that is really Iraqi rather than sectarian. At the moment, we have people who see themselves as victims of the former regime and who are actively competing with one another as victims. Very few of the leading personalities and very few people inside this political class created by 2003 have yet been able to develop what you might call a new Iraqi program, a program that looks to the construction of a new national identity post the Saddam era.
Well, if American troops stay in Iraq until Iraq solves its sectarian and political problems, that sounds like it might be a really long stay.
Well, I'm not saying, you know, American troops should stay in Iraq until all these problems are solved. That is really, there are two issues here, two separate issues. And I do want to put to you the very difficult dilemma that what is in American best interest may not very well be what is in Iraqi best interest. It's a sad and difficult thing for me to say, but it is nonetheless true. It may very well be that from a purely American sort of self-interest point of view, it might be better to withdraw from certain, you know, sooner after certain steps are taken. But I'm just telling you the consequences on Iraq of such a withdrawal are the ones I think that I've spelled out. From an Iraqi point of view, it's an unmitigated disaster for the United States to withdraw quickly. And once, and if that is true, it's true that it's a disaster for the region, not only for Iraq.
Do you think if the United States stays in Iraq longer, it will be seen as a commitment to Iraq or as a commitment to occupation? I mean, don't a lot of people really hate the United States for its continued presence in their part of the world?
I don't really by that theory. I mean, I never did, and I still don't think it's true. The errors and mistakes did lead large numbers of people to say, my God, I have no idea. They were so incompetent. I mean, I can't believe this. So some people say they're better off not having been there in the first place. But when push comes to shove, take, for instance, the Sunni community in Iraq today. It's today, of all people, which was the biggest community behind the insurgency, least wants the United States to withdraw, because it now is turning increasingly to the United States as a protector, as a guarantor of its rights inside Iraq until the political situation straightens out. So things are never quite what they seem. True, there was an occupation, but the occupation is now in the past also. The United States is no longer determining everything about Iraqi affairs. It's playing a very important role in the security arena, but it does not decide legislation, constitutional issues, and so on and so forth. The Iraqis do that.
Kanan Makiya, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Kanan Makiya is a professor at Brandeis University and founder of the Iraq Memory Foundation. Today and tomorrow, we're asking the question, when and how do we get out of Iraq? Our next guest, Peter Galbraith, is the Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and was the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. From 1979 to 93, he was the Iraq expert for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He worked closely with the Kurds in documenting Saddam Hussein's campaign against them. He's the author of the book, The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. His next book about Iraq, Unintended Consequences, will be published in June. Peter Galbraith, welcome back to Fresh Air. Where did you stand on the invasion of Iraq?
I went along with the invasion, in spite of some reservations, because I believed that the Saddam Hussein regime was a genocidal regime and that its removal would be a good thing for the people of Iraq. And I was wrong. And I should have seen the incompetence, the lack of planning for what happened after we took Baghdad, because I was talking to people in the Pentagon, and I saw the lack of preparation, and I wish I had spoken out about it.
You wrote a book titled The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And you've said, we have an approach that will condemn us to an endless war because we have not bothered to learn a lot about what the country is like. Do you still think we're condemned to an endless war?
If our goal is to try to build a unified, democratic, and stable Iraq, then we're going to be there forever because the country has, in fact, broken apart. It has a civil war between its Sunnis and Shiites, and we have no strategy to resolve any of that.
So is your solution, if you were asked one, to just keep staying until we can work out a unified, stable Iraq, or to get out because you think we'll never accomplish the goal of the unified Iraq?
We won't accomplish the goal of the unified Iraq. I don't even think the goal is a desirable one. Why should we, the Americans, hold together a country where a substantial part of the population of that country doesn't want to be part of the country? My view is that we should get out of the business of nation building in Iraq, accept that Kurdistan in the north is going to continue to be a de facto independent country and probably someday will become fully independent, a member of the United Nations. We might encourage the Sunnis and Shiites, both of whom think of themselves as Iraqi but have diametrically opposed views of what that means, to try to work out some arrangement, some power-sharing arrangement where each administers its own part of the country. But if they can't, I don't think that we should stay there.
Now, I know you had been proposing in the past that Iraq be divided into three separate entities, one for the Kurds, one for the Sunni, and one for the Shia. And I'm wondering if you still think that that's the way to go.
First, I think the United States should not be in the business of partitioning Iraq, and it should not be in the business of trying to put Iraq back together again. Second, Kurdistan already exists as its own region with its own flag, its own army, with no presence of the central government. That ought to remain. The question is whether the Sunni or the Shiites will form their own regions, more or less like Kurdistan. There's a process in the Iraqi constitution that would allow each of these communities to decide if they want to do that or not. But that is their decision, first as to whether they follow the constitutional procedure, and second, whether they actually do that. But regardless of what they do, the U.S. approach ought to be focused on what mission we can accomplish, and where there is no mission to accomplish, and that's true for much of Iraq, we ought to get out.
So when do you think we should get out?
Basically, I think our presence ought to be related to the mission that we can accomplish. And I think we cannot think of Iraq as a single country. And so that if we're going to analyze it, we need to look at it region by region. In the Shiite southern half of the country, there is no mission that we can accomplish. We are not going to make that area democratic because it would involve replacing the Shiite governorate councils and ruling clergy and militias that effectively run the place. And that would involve a whole nother war. It would pit us against the Shiite population, and the Bush administration has no intention of doing that. That being the case, I would get out of southern Iraq immediately. Now, in the case of the Sunni area, the center of the country, the one mission that has been very important to us has been to disrupt al-Qaeda. We have in the last year fallen upon a strategy that has dealt a severe blow to al-Qaeda, and that strategy involved creating a Sunni militia called the Awakening Councils, paying for them, and they in turn have fought al-Qaeda and dealt it a major blow. As long as those councils are able to do that, I would be withdrawing from the Sunni areas, maybe keep a small presence to coordinate with them, but basically be getting out of there.
Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, really great talking to you again, Terry.
Peter Galbraith is Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He's the author of The End of Iraq and a forthcoming book about Iraq titled Unintended Consequences. Our series on when to get out of Iraq continues tomorrow. The series is produced by Monique Nazareth.